supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A natural gas pipeline explosion in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, destroyed one home this morning. Fortunately, no one was injured. The pipeline, called The Revolution, started operating just 1 week ago. Joining me now with more details is State Impact Pennsylvania's Reed Frazier. Reed, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight. And first off, what happened just before 5 this morning?
Well, what we do know is that a pipeline in the woods behind a kind of a dead-end road in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, exploded. The neighbors reported the flames of around 150 feet tall. And just for some kind of visual background, there was the pipeline was sort of behind a row of houses, and sort of after the houses, it kind of goes down a steep ravine into a valley, and it was around there that the explosion occurred.
I understand electrical lines were knocked down as well.
True. We're not sure what exactly happened. Maybe the poles burned or something buckled from the heat, but this was a major fireball. People reported, you know, they thought it was one guy told me he thought it was a meteor at first that hit the ground nearby. Somebody else said they thought it was a jet crashing, but just it's a 24-inch pipeline, which has a lot of gas going through it and, you know, a lot of fuel for this fire.
What's the status of the investigation and who's conducting it?
Well, there's a mix of federal and state sort of regulatory agencies that could play a role in the investigation. The pipeline company that owns it, Energy Transfer Partners, is sending inspectors and investigators en route to see what happens. Already, officials are pointing the finger at perhaps a landslide. As I mentioned, this was kind of hilly terrain. This pipeline, as you mentioned, just came online last week. And some of the neighbors said that the pipeline crews were still out in their yards even just a few days ago, kind of finishing up the pipeline route. So there's been 4 or 5 inches of rain here in western Pennsylvania in the last, you know, day and a half. This is a sort of brand new, pipeline route. And so there's been some earth movement near where the explosion occurred. So that's what officials are pointing towards.
Is there questions now whether this pipeline was built to withstand 4 to 5 inches of rain? I presume this was not a storm of the century.
Well, the local police chief said, you know, he's got a lot of these tough questions for whichever regulator it is, or whatever the company, whoever the company officials are, as to, you know, why this happened, as well, and a lot of the neighbors do too. They were aware that this pipeline was going in. A lot of them were concerned that it was close to houses. Some thought, you know, this is a safe way to transport this stuff, and now they're having second thoughts about that assumption.
In the short run, do things return to some semblance of normalcy tomorrow in terms of schools opening and roadways cleared?
Yeah, the local gas company checked all the gas meters on the street that was evacuated. It's about 25 to 30 homes. And they let around 3 o'clock this afternoon, they started letting people back into their houses. So they'll at least be able to check on their pets and make sure, you know, their dogs and cats are still with us, and, you know, get on with their lives and go to work, et cetera.
Reed, thanks for the update.
No problem.
State Impact Pennsylvania's Reed Frazier on NewsWorks Tonight. In other news this evening, Delaware Governor John Carney signed 3 pieces of legislation today aimed at addressing overdose deaths from heroin and other drugs. WHYY's Zoe Reed reports.
The new law set in motion recommendations from Delaware's Behavioral Health Consortium. One establishes the nation's first overdose care system. It sets up standards for stabilization centers to take over caring for overdose patients once they are released from hospitals or first responders. Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long, who leads the consortium, says this will provide personalized access to care.
The first in the nation first system will be working with first responders, fire service, paramedics, the emergency rooms, and instead of sending someone home, we will get them in, hopefully into the treatment. And that is the difference. You know, when you have a heart attack, when you go in and have a stroke, they don't give you one dose of medicine and send you home. That's what we've been doing with persons who have overdose or persons who are in a crisis. We oftentimes, whether it's a mental health breakdown or if they're having a substance use breakdown, we send them home. So now the goal is to, down the road, have these stabilization centers and getting them into treatment.
Another law will analyze overdose data collected by the state's prescription monitoring program and then train doctors on how to prescribe opioids to minimize the risk of addiction. It will also teach them how to identify patients with a substance abuse problem. The third law encourages prescribers and patients to use non-opioid methods to treat back pain, from acupuncture to physical therapy to other medications. Last year in Delaware, 345 people died from overdoses. From the Delaware desk, Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
There's rain, and more rain in the five-day forecast for the Philadelphia region. And a major tropical storm is headed for the southeast, only likely to make things worse. Joining me now is Sarah Johnson, meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Mount Holly. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We had a brief respite this morning and early afternoon. How much rain has fallen and what might we anticipate?
Well, across the area, what we've seen over the last 2 days has been generally in the up to 1 inch to, in some places, up to 3 inches. It's been a kind of slower, steady rain than what we have seen with some of the events that we've had in the last few weeks. So that was good news in that it didn't cause as much flooding issues as what we have seen lately, at least as far as the rainwater flooding.
But with more rain in the forecast, regardless of whether it's slow and steady, will there come a point where area rivers and creeks could overflow their banks?
At this point, at least for the next few days, it looks like we will have a little bit of a reprieve. As you mentioned, though, what we are keeping an eye on is Hurricane Florence. Currently, it's forecast to make landfall in the Carolinas. Beyond the 5 day period, the track is very uncertain. So it's uncertain right now, but it is possible that we could see some heavy rain from this hurricane. And if we do get that, as you mentioned, we have had a lot of rain already, which means we already have some pretty saturated ground. So it would not take much to cause additional flooding issues.
But to be clear, this storm to date has nothing to do with Florence on the way.
That's correct. It was actually a combination of a low-pressure system and the remnants of another tropical system, Gordon, which had been in the Gulf last week, Gulf of Mexico, and it was making slow track to the northeast. But yes, we have not seen any of the moisture with Florence. That's still well offshore.
Is this much moisture normal for September?
We can see heavy rain when we get into tropical systems, which again, we kind of looked at, looking at the remnants of what we just saw and, the potential coming up, later, if we see anything with Florence, that would also be associated with a tropical system. So if we do get, heavy rain in the September, it is, most often associated with tropical systems or the remnants of tropical systems.
Sarah, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure.
Sarah Johnson, meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Mount Holly, New Jersey. Reproductive health clinics that provide abortions began popping up in Pittsburgh after the Supreme Court guaranteed the right to have the procedure in 1973. The clinics attracted patients who needed abortions and other reproductive health services, but soon they became targets for anti-abortion protests. For WHYY, Lucy Perkins looks at how those protest groups began in Pittsburgh and why they became a model for other demonstrations across the country.
Some call them reproductive health clinics, but protesters like Kathy Laszlo call them abortuaries. She's standing outside the Planned Parenthood in downtown Pittsburgh on a rainy Friday morning this summer.
I found a song by Seals and Croft called Unborn Child. It was released a year after Roe versus Wade.
She's 56 and lives in the North Hills. She volunteers for Sidewalk Advocates for Life, an anti-abortion rights group. She played this song for another volunteer during their shift.
I thought, wow, this is kind of like what we do. You know, we're trying to say, stop, you know, think it over, you know. There's help around, you know.
Laszlo has been volunteering outside of clinics for the last 4 years. Her job is to talk to women who are on their way to Planned Parenthood and tell them that there are other places they can go.
Hi, could I offer you some free help, dear? We have free services, miss? Birth control? Yeah. Oh, okay. I have something for you, too.
Okay.
If you've never read
it. I talked to her for a while.
Yeah, a little bit. But my goal wasn't achieved because she went in.
Her success rate for changing women's minds is really low, so her faith in God is what keeps her going. It's also what motivated her to get involved with anti-abortion rights activism in the first place. These days, the anti-abortion rights movement relies heavily on people like Laszlo, and an evangelical pastor from Pittsburgh is one of the reasons why. Pastor Keith Tusey started a small church called Word and Worship in North Braddock in 1982.
Our group was like six people. That's what we had.
His sermons focused a lot on what the Bible said about abortion. Soon, his words turned into action, and he led protests with members of his congregation outside clinics.
We were out on the streets in Pittsburgh. We just didn't have media coverage.
That would change soon. In May of 1987, he crossed paths with an activist named Randall Terry. Terry was the leader of an anti-abortion group called Operation Rescue. The group got attention for clinic protests in other states.
He said, you've got to do something to send a message. And as a result, in the city of Pittsburgh, we had one of the largest rescue movements across the country. You know, it broke loose. It just became a phenomenon.
Tusey started an Operation Rescue chapter in Pittsburgh. And over the next few years, Operation Rescue and Tusey's church held rallies with protesters numbering in the thousands.
I think what made it so successful is we reframed the question. We made it about Jesus and the Bible and his intentions for mankind.
Tusey says the tactics that Operation Rescue used were always peaceful. But newspaper archives from the Pittsburgh Press and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette detail stories of anti-abortion rights protesters coating the floors of a downtown clinic in tar and blocking the doors to a clinic with a car.
It was so overwhelming to everybody.
This is Claire Keyes. She was the director of the Allegheny Reproductive Health Center for decades. Operation Rescue protested outside her clinic. She says they blocked the doors and made it impossible for anyone to get in or out of the building. Other tenants couldn't get to their offices. Doctors couldn't get into the clinic. Patients would wait at a nearby McDonald's until city services cleared the protesters.
And we would tell them, you will be seen, because some of them would say, well, I'll just go home and come back. And well, it could be just like this the next time you come. And we promise you that once they're cleared, we will see every single patient.
Sometimes police arrested more than 100 protesters in a day. Protesters would refuse to give their names or move, and police had to carry them away from clinic doors. Tusey estimates he's been arrested over 15 times in Pittsburgh.
There was a soft underbelly there we knew we could exploit, and we did, and that's what got us sued, because we were hurting their business, and that was a wonderful thing to us.
Keyes says the disruption eventually forced them to relocate.
That landlord said, I'm pro-choice, but goodbye.
Other anti-abortion groups around the country noticed Pittsburgh and adopted similar tactics. Tusey himself went from being the leader of a six-member congregation to his current state of traveling to churches across the country and around the world. Tusey believes that part of the reason for that is videos that were filmed in Pittsburgh were watched throughout the country. They were made so other groups could learn effective protest tactics from Tusey's group. Keyes acknowledges that the strategies used in Pittsburgh spread elsewhere. And she says those cities also look to the city of Pittsburgh for advice about how to handle those protests.
And then those cities looked back to Pittsburgh, like, okay, we want to learn from you. How did you deal with him? Who did you have to get into the process?
While all of this happened in Pittsburgh, lawmakers in Harrisburg were busy too. They created some of the most extreme abortion legislation in the country. Here's Sue Fritchie at the Women's Law Project.
The 1988 and 1989 Abortion Control Acts were a set of regulations that were designed specifically to get to the Supreme Court so that Pennsylvania would be the state that resulted in the overruling of Roe.
That didn't happen, but in just a few years, Pennsylvania would become a model for anti-abortion activists again. I'm Lucy Perkins in Pittsburgh.
We are fast approaching the tipping point where dark skies overtake the amount of daylight. Let's get into it with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, say it ain't so.
You know, I hate to say it ain't so, but the planet keeps orbiting around the sun. So first of all, sunrises these days are at around 6:30 a.m. Sunsets are at about 7:15. So we've added quite a few minutes of darkness to our evening time, which extends our viewing time. Now, in that viewing time, we have this wonderful opportunity to still catch four of the brightest planets of our solar system visible for observing in the evening just after sunset. But that's not going to last. Venus, in its motion around the sun, is coming down lower and lower in our evening skies. The translation is that it appears to be setting earlier and earlier, that is, closer to sunset time. So Venus is going to disappear within another week and a half or so from easy observing. We'll still be left with Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars, but we're going to lose Jupiter next month. Then we'll be left with Saturn and Mars. Saturn will go, and then Mars will be left. And we won't have an opportunity to see at least three planets in the evening sky again until September of 2020. So this is a great time for people to be out, again, observing these four planets under warm weather conditions in a lovely evening sky.
Even better viewing if one has an avail for a telescope.
Indeed, that's true. So tomorrow night at Franklin Institute, Night Skies at the Observatory, we'll be featuring those four planets. And if you think you might want to do this work at home in the weeks that we have left of observing, you may have a telescope at home, or you're interested in purchasing a telescope, I'm going to give a presentation tomorrow night explaining the things you need to look for to make a good telescope purchase.
Oh, a credit card.
Yeah, that would be a start, not mine.
Derek, where do we stand in the continuing hunt for planets beyond our solar system?
So the best-known planetary hunting spacecraft ever is the Kepler Planetary Discoverer. It's been in orbit since 2013, and to date, it's identified 2,653 planets orbiting other stars. The upshot of its observations is that astronomers now believe it's more likely for a star to have at least one planet than to have no planets. But the real hunt that we're interested in understanding is how many of those planets are Earth-like. And so we start out at the point of thinking how many of them have some kind of water as part of their chemistry. And so into the picture now comes James Webb Space Telescope, launched next year, hopefully. The work that it will begin to do in the 2020s will be a more detailed examination of planetary atmospheres that will help us understand how much more Earth-like they might be.
This is starting to sound more and more like the type of science fiction that was first posited over a half century ago on a little TV show called Star Trek.
Yes, that's right. Only 79 episodes, but they were iconic because, and remember, this is 1966, 3 years before humans landed on the moon. But this program really defined a whole new approach to space exploration and its impact on world culture because, after all, we wanted to emulate a lot of the stuff that we saw in Star Trek. But it wasn't just about space, it was about social commentary as well. Even in its episodes and its stories, it reflected a lot of those social issues that were happening on the planet at the time. They may have appeared to be masked in some way because of the science fiction overlay, but if you really look very carefully, you'll find that it really was this incredible mirror of the social condition at the time.
Just have to ask, was that show in part inspirational to your compassion development?
That's a really great question, because in fact, Star Trek really was a great influence on my interest in astronomy and space exploration. Here was a program that had a cast representing people doing exactly what I wanted to do in an environment very much like I would have wanted to be. And in fact, if I were to drop a little secret, you know, I would say that certainly my favorite character on that program and the person that I wanted to emulate more than any other was Mr. Spock. You know, it's the idea that science describes the universe and that scientists merely report on what the universe is doing without emotion. And if we take enough time to learn about the universe and how it manifests itself, we might be able to understand it in ways that we can use to our benefit.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.